Hi, I'm John Wolfstall, host of We're All Gonna Die Radio here on the Deep State Radio Network. If you're interested in the intersection of cutting-edge technologies, national security, and the things that may just kill us all, then please give our show a listen every Friday. Members of the Deep State Radio Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 a year. As a thanks for listening, I'm offering a 25% discount off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code cyber. That's thedsrnetwork.com/BUY and code cyber. Thank you, and thanks for listening.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to yet another episode of We're All Gonna Die Radio. Congratulations on surviving through to another week and another episode. You're gonna be glad you held on for another week because we're really excited and, I'll tell you quite frankly, honored that our guest today is Annie Jacobson, a tremendously accomplished author with a new book. But before we get to Annie, I wanna say hi to my partner, Heather Williams. Hello, Heather.
Hi, John. I am so excited for today. Let's dive right in.
You should be excited for today because we get to talk about all of our favorite things like nuclear war and conflict and North Korea and destruction. And it's all for the low cost of 1995, 21. I forget what that goes for these days. Annie will tell us. Annie Jacobson is author of a number of books. She's a Pulitzer Prize finalist. She's the author of Area 51. She's the author of Operation Paperclip. And she's the author of a new book, which puts her squarely in the nuclear priesthood for the rest of her life, called Nuclear War, A Scenario. She's in the midst of a major international book tour. And we're honored to have you on the show today, Annie. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
Annie, we're nuclear geeks, and we think about the apocalypse all the time. We do it over drinks, we do it over lunch, we do it, you know, when we're getting ready in the morning. What made you dark enough that you wanted to write a book about nuclear war?
So thank you for that intro. And as you know, I'm an investigative journalist who writes about war and weapons and national security and government secrets. And as the author of six previous books that cover everything from the CIA, the Pentagon, DARPA, all military and intelligence programs, I cannot tell you how many sources told me with sort of, you know, pride that they dedicated their lives to preventing nuclear World War III. And so during the previous administration, the kind of fire and fury rhetoric coming from then President Trump, I began to wonder what would happen if deterrence failed? And I took that question to the highest level, top tier national security people that I could locate on this issue. And the result is Nuclear War, A Scenario.
So, Annie, can you say a little bit more about some of those folks that you talked to? Because, you know, John had mentioned this before we got started, that this book it's going to get some criticism from the quote-unquote nuclear priesthood. And I think we can anticipate some of those criticisms. And so I think it would be really helpful just to kind of hear how you went about trying to dive into this ultra-secret world. And who were the types of people that you were talking to do the research for it?
You know, it's interesting because in my previous books, one always lists their sources at the end. In this book, I made a decision to list everyone right up front because it is a scenario, because it deals with a hypothetical fact-based situation in the future that we all hope we never have happen. I wanted people, readers, that is, to know right away who it was that I spoke to. And of course, I went to the smartest people in the room, the, you know, top tier national security people I could locate, people like Richard Garwin, the designer of the Ivy Mike thermonuclear bomb, people like former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, who was also the director of the CIA and the White House chief of staff. The list goes on. And the reason I did that is so that I could really drill down on a lot of the inevitable criticism that always comes my way. You cannot be a high performing author without having critics. It's just part of the game. I wish it wasn't a game, but because it shouldn't be a game, but it is, and that's okay.
Although lots of our friends make a good living running war games all the time, Annie. So, you know, we don't want to criticize people here, even though, you know, that if you thought writing a book about nukes was dark, like running war games all day is really a shady place. One of the things that's great about the book is not only the people that you interviewed, but the bibliography and the list of resources. I never have to write a syllabus again when I teach a class. I'm just going to sort of go to the book and pull things out. But, you know, so, you know, Heather and I, we geek out on nuclear people all the time. Like I ran into Dick Garwin at the White House cafeteria one day and brought him to my office for 3 hours. So tell me, give us an anecdote from your interactions. Obviously, you talk to people like Secretary of Defense Perry, Dick Garwin, you know, you talk to people that are the global experts on this. So what are some of the things you found that really, let's say, surprised you in those conversations? Mm-hmm.
John, everything did. I mean, literally, it was one jaw-dropping realization after the next. And, you know, I think the most important concept to keep in mind when we're discussing this book that I wrote is that I aim to be a bridge between, you know, the average Joe or Jane and the world of experts, because that's what a journalist does. At least that's how I was trained. It's also why I have no opinion on politics. For example, I write about POTUS, the President of the United States. I don't write about the personality of the current or the former president, because no one should be for nuclear war. No one should be for the various subjects that I write about. Rather, I want people to be able to form their own opinions. That is the hallmark of democracy. I mean, one of the reasons I think that I am able to get so many really fascinating, wise, legitimate individuals to talk to me is because when they say to me, "Why should I talk to you?" I often cite what I call the Eisenhower principle. And it's his exit speech, not the first part of it about the military-industrial complex, which is so well known, but rather the second part of that speech where he says, it's an alert and knowledgeable citizenry that makes for a democracy. Mm. And that's what I'm after. Educate the people in the easiest way possible. Make something enjoyable to read, enjoyable to learn. Let people feel part of the conversation, not looked down upon by some phony, you know, pundit with a PhD.
You described what you learned as jaw-dropping. And I think that that's been most people's reactions when they read the book. But I also just want to give praise to your earlier book, Operation Paperclip, that I absolutely loved. And I remember reading it and my jaw just dropping at some of these historical facts that you found and the way that you kind of roll them out in this very storytelling nature. And so I think that this is all a really important service to get the wider general audience to engage with and care about these issues. And I mean, John and I talk about this almost every week on the podcast. How do we get people on Capitol Hill? How do we get our families and neighbors mm-hmm. to care about these issues? And so I think that that's a really important achievement of the book. And one other thing you said that I kind of want to come back to a bit when you said, no one should be for nuclear war. How do you think that resonates and plays out in kind of the current political landscape? Does it strike you that anybody is for nuclear war, or is kind of challenging what I think is a truism as well?
Well, as you guys know, because you're on the inside baseball team, as I would say, right? So you know that there are polemics involved in terms of people, you know, this idea of deterrence, that more nukes is going to keep us safer. And then the lines tend to be drawn to those who are sort of, you know, for a strong, you know, national security apparatus, and put that in air quotes, please, whatever that means. We could discuss for hours. And then there are those who are, you know, on the side of nuclear non-proliferation, and those are very, very important dialogues, and they're very important positions, and there are incredibly wise and learned people in those. That's not the point of my book. The point of my book is simply to demonstrate in appalling detail, detail that is not made up by Annie Jacobson's imagination, but rather deeply sourced from Defense Department documents like the effects of nuclear weapons, also called, by the way, Army pamphlet number 50, you know, which describes in horrific detail what nuclear weapons do to people and to things. And that's what my goal is, to let people know, okay, guys, guess what? This is what would happen in seconds and minutes. And then let them decide where they want to, you know, how they want to pick their battles.
Heather, I just want to compliment you, because obviously when she said pundits with a PhD, she didn't mean you, but you didn't take the bait. So I just think that's great. Just because you're a doctor doesn't mean that you're, you know, sort of on the point. I did like that you talked about us being inside baseball players, because it means we're all Yankees and on the team. So that's
Stop it. I will take that bait. Stop it.
And wait, I have to correct the pundits with a PhD, because here's the thing is, you can be as educated as you want. Everyone should strive for what they personally desire. But the place I take issue is when somebody takes a pious attitude toward others who are not necessarily as learned or as educated, in again in air quotes, as they are, because that is being, and I'm not saying anyone here in this Zoom is doing that, but we all know people do, and that is an embarrassment to them, in my opinion.
So Annie, when Heather talked about what we go to routinely on this podcast, and we don't kid ourselves, you know, we know we're not like some of the shows you've been on and some of the events you're doing in terms of our reach, but we hear this all the time, particularly from advocates for nuclear modernization and nuclear investment, that there's a consensus in this country to modernize U.S. nuclear forces. And these people say, we want a national discussion, we want national support. And then, God forbid, somebody injects their opinion into the debate. If they are not as learned, as pedigreed, they get shouted down. And we see this routinely. And again, I've seen this right in criticism, not only of you, of others. And I think that's part of the challenge. It's that this is not a bug. This is a feature of the system. The nuclear complex was built in a way to be exclusionary. The language that was developed, the false quantitative nature of nuclear deterrence was created to build barriers. And it is an undemocratic system, down to the decision to use nuclear weapons, which is invested in the president, and there are no real checks and balances on that. And I want to get to that with you, because I think that's a critical element that the book brings out, again, without pointing fingers at one president or another, but just talking about how our system works. In the United States, the president has the authority and the capability to launch nuclear weapons and to bypass most of his senior leaders. Now, in a normal day, in a normal president, we wouldn't see that. We'd want to see a president bring these people in. But in the book, you talk about decision-making under a crisis. And I want you to walk us through that a little bit, because I think it illustrates this challenge in a really dramatic way.
That's right. And what I did, John, is take situations, present them to my various sources, garner their opinions based on their experience, and then lay out what would happen next in the scenario. And if anyone wants to kind of nerd out on this, or even wonder, wait a minute, where is she coming up with this, you know, hypothetical situation in this particular seen, they can go to the back of the book and see in notes, for example, when there's a debate between, you know, Stratcom wanting the president to give a counterattack and the Secret Service insistent upon getting the president out of the White House, you can source and see, oh, she talked to a former SecDef about his experience in that situation, and also a former director of the Secret Service and a member of the CAT team, the counter-assault team, to find out what they would do and who might win that argument. And so these are the kind of, you know, decision trees that I think people will find dramatic and shocking. And again, to keep, you know, you guys know launch on morning, you guys know sole presidential authority like the back of your hand. The average person walking down the street has absolutely no idea. The average person, by the way, and I know this because I do lots of podcasts aimed at regular old people like me. People do not even understand what the nuclear triad is. They don't know a ballistic missile, an intercontinental ballistic missile, takes 30 minutes. They have no idea that America has a satellite system in space called SBIRS that can detect the hot rocket exhaust on a ballistic missile launching in under 1 second. This is absolutely new information to, I guarantee you, 99% of the population. And so how could anyone be asked to have a voice in your nuclear, you know, modernization debate if they don't even know these things? And my God, who has time to sit down and read a monograph produced by the Air Force about all of this? They need it spoon-fed, and that's what journalism really is. It's aimed to you know, go to the direct heart of America, somebody with a high school education.
Heather and I both have stacks of Air Force monographs on our bedstand, mm-hmm. So, you know, it's we're the target audience for that.
Those are my door stops.
but to this point about language and the way that we talk about nuclear issues, I really appreciate this, any effort, honestly, to try to remove some of it from the politicization and to break things down and say, what are we actually talking about here? You know, when we talk about SBIRS, what does that actually mean? Not just what is the acronym, but what does that mean in practice? And I think I would politely push back on something John said earlier. I don't think it's just the nuclear modernization crowd who sometimes looks down on the other side. Or can be somewhat condescending and critical if you don't have certain credentials, for example. But I think what Annie's book and everything Annie's saying and talking about is, in the nuclear field, we do have this polarization effect where we all go to our corners. And I mean, it's a very small room, but it still has corners in it. And we face off against each other. And I just really appreciate the attempt of being like, no, I'm going to, you know, for what Annie is doing is saying, here are the facts of what happens in a nuclear explosion. Here are the facts of what could happen to a human body. Here are consequences of these things. And trying to lay those out in a way that doesn't necessarily have to force us into those corners. And, you know, Annie, I read one interview you did with The Guardian, and you just had this great quote. I'm going to quote you, where you said, nuclear weapons and the whole nomenclature around them have been so rarefied, it's been reserved as a subject for those in the know. And that rarefication of the language, I think you really hit on something. But as you were writing, Were there any terms or any language in particular that you just found really troublesome, and that you just thought either this doesn't make sense the way that we're framing it, or it's somewhat disingenuous how this is being framed?
Well, you know, this is not my first rodeo in the nuclear world, in as much that my very first book, Area 51, you know, much to my surprise, I was writing about aerial espionage programs that the CIA and the Air Force were conducting out at the Nevada test site. And of course, that led me to, you know, the Nevada test site, all the atmospheric weapons tests out there. And many of the people who worked in Area 51 also worked at the test site. And so I got like sort of the quickie, you know, master's degree in nuclear weapons from the actual engineers who exploded the bombs. And so when you talk about that, those rarefied terms, my approach is always storytelling through people, right? Mm-hmm. It's through characters. That becomes really interesting. And I am a journalist who is willing to sit with someone for 10, 20, 100 hours, if necessary, and just hang out with them and discuss the terrain. And then you begin to learn how they feel about what they did, which to me is the most interesting part of it and the most relatable. And so to your point about rarefied language, all that goes away if you're sitting at a diner with somebody having a hamburger talking about, you know, Operation Baker out at the test site and what it was like to wire a bomb.
Mm. You know, Heather, until you named it, I didn't put a label to one of the aspects of the book, which I think is rare in our world, because one of the reasons I think we get along is we try to get beyond our stovepipes and we try to engage people on different sides of the debate, even though we have our own opinions about these things. I'm thinking in my head through the book and reading it, and it really is a nonpartisan book. Hmm. Like there's no pejorative characterizations of this person or that person, or, you know, here's a stable, experienced political hand at the helm or a novice, you know, demagogue. It's basically, this is step by step how the nuclear command and decision process would work. And here are the effects. And yet in the discussions I've heard about the book already, it's getting pulled in one direction or another, right? People will use it for their to advance their cause. This is an argument for disarmament. This is an argument for greater investment in the nuclear modernization program. Or this is an argument for, you know, negotiating with North Korea. And so, Anne, I wonder, in your interviews, you know, you were raised as a journalist in a different period. Journalism is viewed with different lens now, right? People are skeptical of journalism. Did you encounter any of that skepticism, or it sounds like people were eager to share with you? Did you find that it was an open faucet, or that you had to sort of pull a little bit?
Well, you know, this is my seventh book, and a lot of people I called up and would say, and begin to explain who I am, and they would say, I know, I've read your books. And that's one of the great joys when you stay on a subject long enough. I write about military and intelligence programs, and, you know, again, speaking to the critics, I don't really care much about the critics, because I just keep doing what I'm doing. And I have seen a lot of people get sidelined by trying to, what I call, people please. You know, I'm not really out to please anyone. I'm just simply out to write the next book that is hopefully a little bit more elegant than the last book. And so, again, you know, here's the best example I can think of. I get a lot of fan mail, and I got a letter from someone who said, I'm a truck driver, and all my life people have tried to tell me that I'm not very smart. And I have read, and then the person said, actually listened to every one of your books, and now I know I am very smart. And that's what I'm after.
That's pretty good. We Heather and I think we're successful because we prevent nuclear war. You actually, you know, get letters like that. That sounds like a good gig.
I mean, as a former academic, I'm kind of like, if five people read something that I wrote, that would be considered a good day, and at least one of them would be my mother. So
I read a couple of your things, Heather. So that's two right there.
There's two, and it's a couple more. You know, Annie, as you were talking, and John was talking about this attempt to be nonpartisan and not politicize things, I couldn't help but, it's really reminded me of the humanitarian impacts movement. I mean, this is getting wonky, and I realize that, but like the conferences in 2013 and 2014, which brought together, you know, a really diverse crowd to talk about the facts of nuclear weapons use. And I think it's a little bit of a shame that one kind of part of the nuclear community has somewhat monopolized those humanitarian-based conversations. And so what do you hope that this type of conversation, this facts-based conversation about humanitarian effects and about what nuclear weapons can do, what do you hope it leads to?
Well, the more educated people that you have, the better off we all are, because you can have a variety of opinions. So of course you're going to have arguments within that any kind of big debate. What it reminds me of is what I call the Reagan reversal. If there's a wish that I would have, and now I'm going to date myself here, but you know, in 1983, when I was a high school student, I saw the ABC miniseries The Day After on television, which, you know, for those listeners who aren't familiar with that, depicted a fictional war between America and then the Soviet Union. And it was absolutely horrific and you know, in every way, and depressing. And 100 million Americans also watched it. And among them, a very important American, President Ronald Reagan. Before that, he had been pro-nuclear weapons. I mean, I don't have to tell you about SDI and how much he was the president who was, you know, project supremacy and do that through a massive nuclear arsenal. And after seeing the Day After miniseries, he became, quote, greatly depressed. And as a result, he reached out to Gorbachev. And the Reykjavik summit was a result of their conversations, again, communication. And the world has gone from 70,000 nuclear warheads to the 12,500 we have today. So when you can talk about cause and effect, that's the best example I can think of.
So, Annie, this is the part on We're All Gonna Die where we take a short break and we have to say goodbye to a number of our listeners. Our paying members will have a chance to listen to the rest of the podcast. And for those of you that aren't yet subscribers to Deep State Radio Network, we encourage you to go to deepstateradio.com. For $7 a month, you can become a subscriber. You will get access to all of the content on this podcast, past and current, and access to all the other Deep State Radio podcasts that David Rothkopf and the team put together. Highly recommend it. For $7 a month, you can be as smart as the truck driver that listens to Annie's books on the road, and probably smarter than myself for sure, since I don't listen to all of David's podcasts. But for those of you that are not members, we'll have to say goodbye. And for those of you that are paying members, bear with us.